You can visit that bit.ly link and download a zip file that has tons of code, lots of demo code that covers all the topics that we'll be talking about in today's session. And so you can jot that link down, and then we'll get started promptly at 2:45, which is, looks like, just about now. Actually, I've got a bigger one right here. How's that? All right, and if you need me to throw it back up again at the end of the session, I'll be happy to do that. I'll back up one slide and introduce myself. My name is Lenny Lobel, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm from New York City, and I'm here today to talk to you about DocumentDB. I run my own company back in New York called Sleep Technologies. I'm also an MVP in SQL Server for now 5 years. I do lots of speaking and writing. I've written several books on SQL and done a number of Pluralsight courses as well. And most germane to today's session, only in the past few days, my newest Pluralsight course was just released on Azure Document DB. So it's if you want a nice kind of like 5-hour treatment of it goes into a bit more depth than we'll have time to cover in 1 hour today, I definitely encourage you to check out my new Pluralsight course on Azure Document DB. And it would actually be helpful at this point if I could do a quick survey just to get an idea. I mean, I'm not expecting any past experience with NoSQL or document databases, but just to do a quick survey, how many folks have dabbled with NoSQL in general? NoSQL technologies? Not too many, and that's fine. So then I'm going to, you know, DocumentDB in particular would be, or MongoDB or anything like that would be too fine-grained a question. So, and that's fine, because we're going to start by talking about a little bit about what NoSQL is and what it isn't. And got that URL up there, and I'll throw it up again at the end of the session. Again, at this link you'll find a zip file with tons of demo code that for all of the topics that we'll be talking about today. So we'll start by talking about what is a NoSQL document database. We're going to start by actually clearing up some unfortunate terminology. So NoSQL does not mean no structured query language, because SQL is just a language, right? And really, non-relational would be more accurate. This is an unfortunate fact that we've jumped on this term NoSQL. SQL is so often equated with relational databases, because it is the language that we use for relational databases, that somehow this set of technologies, key value stores, column stores, graph databases, document databases, this whole class of non-relational databases got dubbed as NoSQL. It doesn't necessarily mean that some version of SQL couldn't be used to query these things. And there are different types of NoSQL databases. There are key value stores like Azure Table Storage, column stores like Cassandra, there are graph databases, there are document databases, and these are all under the umbrella term of NoSQL, and they all have certain characteristics in common, first of which is they're designed to scale out. Sure, you can scale relational databases up easily enough, you can add more RAM and more CPU until you hit the ceiling on RAM and you hit the ceiling on hardware, and now you have to scale out, and that's much more difficult to do with relational databases like SQL Server and Oracle. When I say scale out, I mean horizontally partitioning your data across. Welcome.
Sorry.
No worries at all. Another very common characteristic of NoSQL platforms is the notion of schema-free data. So every item that you store in a NoSQL database is free to be structured either the same or different than any other item in the database. And the simplicity rules. Simple is key. How they scale and how they perform as well as they do is because they are simple by design. Right? So despite the negative connotation in the term NoSQL, which sounds very negative, certainly trying to replace relational databases is not the stated goal. They cannot and do not replace relational databases, which are often better suited at much more complex requirements. You can do a lot of things that are much more complex still today with a relational database that you can't do with a document database. So they're simple, they're lean, and that's what keeps them fast and easy to use. And so now we've described NoSQL in general. We understand NoSQL really means non-relational. It's whatever, you know, however you go about querying this database, it's a database that abandons many of the general tenets or, you know, ideas or concepts of relational databases. And we'll be doing a comparison in a moment. But the term document database, which is a type of NoSQL database, this is yet another unfortunate term, because when most people hear the word document, they think PDF file or Word document, and this is certainly not the type of document that we're talking about when we're talking about a document database. In the case of a document database or a NoSQL document database, we're typically talking about JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. This is a simple, lightweight format that yet is expressive enough that you can really model your data in almost any shape that you need to. So now we understand that NoSQL really means non-relational, and that document databases are one type of NoSQL database. Let's compare relational databases, which is we're all familiar with this brave new world of document databases. So we have a kind of a side-by-side comparison. First of all, in our relational world, of course, we store data in rows, but in the document store, we store them as documents. So instead of rows in a table, we have documents in our document database. Within those rows, in the relational store, of course, we have columns. And the analogy in the document world is that you have properties, right? And standard JSON formatted properties in each document. In the relational world, of course, we have strongly typed schemas. So here I have a table with four columns, and it would be necessary for me to go in and alter the schema of this table if I wanted to add a fifth column, right? Or if I wanted to allow for longer names, or if I wanted to allow nulls in date of birth. You get the idea. Any kind of change you want to make to the schema would require first altering the table. The document database, on the other hand, doesn't really care. Here I have a document with a name property. Here's another document, except it's got a full name property. And here's yet a third document with a full name property that itself is an object nested within it, are distinct first and last names. And the document database is happy, more than happy, to accept all these variations. Now, of course, it normally wouldn't make sense to mix things up like this just because you can. Just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? So in this case, we could speculate that, you know, initially we went with the property name. At some point later on, we decided that full name was a better name for that property than simply name. And then yet, even at some further point down the road, we decided that it would be better to have a full name property that has distinct first and last names in it. And this is a huge selling point of document databases. Yes, they can't replace relational databases, but the things that they do well, they do very, very well. And in terms of keeping up with an evolving schema, and your schema is constantly evolving, there's a lot of friction involved with the relational way of doing things, where anytime you need to make a change, the schema that has to be updated for the table, and then ripple effect, right? Then there's this kind of rippling effect, and it bubbles up all the way throughout your entire stack anytime there's a change. With a relational database, you can just, hey, it's better to have you can introduce a new property one day and not have to modify any schemas. Another very, very, very big difference between relational databases and document databases has to do with data normalization, right? In the relational database world, as everyone in this room knows, we strive to normalize data as much as possible. And that means putting things in their distinct tables and avoiding duplicate data. So if I have a user table and each user has stock holdings, well then the user will get stored in one table, their holdings will get stored in another table. And of course there are many, many more tables. To get the complete picture, you store things in many different tables. And to get the complete picture, you have to join these tables together, right? So there's a lot of joins involved. And similarly, once you've joined all this data and brought it into your application and the user makes edits and they want to save changes, well, now you have to kind of split this out. You have to take this kind of object graph that represents this one unified version of the data and separate it out, kind of shred it out to update all the respective tables that might need updating. It's a whole different world with a document database. In the document database, we typically denormalize our data. So if you look at this document, it's hierarchical. It's a hierarchical JSON document that has contained within it the user and their holdings as a JSON array. So everything is self-contained in a single document, and suddenly this means no joins are necessary to get at this data. I query for the document, and I get the data and all of its related data without these kind of complex joins. Furthermore, once changes are made to this data, it's one document that needs to be updated. Right? No need to shred this out and figure out which tables need to be updated. In fact, no need for an ORM layer at all, an object relational mapping layer. No one loves Entity Framework more than I do, but you know, it is a big piece of that stack. It's a lot of work to keep things normalized. separate them out into separate tables. When you save them out to disk, join them when you pull them in from disk. And even if you are leveraging the assistance of an entity, of an object relational mapper like Entity Framework, it's still effort. And having, you know, it's very compelling to be working with a database where the way the data is stored in the database is exactly the way it is materialized in your application, and you don't have this ORM layer. So you eliminate the ORM layer, you have that combined with a schema-free design. That's what makes these document databases very compelling. Of course, this isn't a silver bullet that works well in every scenario. You have to look at every scenario differently, and document databases aren't always the answer. Take, for example, the case of unbounded data, where I have, let's say, a blog post with comments. Well, it might not be feasible to store in one document the blog post and all of the comments when you start getting into the hundreds of thousands or millions of comments. And in a situation like that, you may want to actually, do things a little bit more the way you would in the relational world, which is to say, well, I'll have one document for the blog post, and then I'll store the comments in each additional separate document, and not worry about this unbounded data that it can just allow it to grow. Of course, you can do this, but you're kind of going against the grain of NoSQL databases, because it's going to be your job to select these documents separately, because the document database will not join them for you, and it'll be your job to push them out separately as well. But of course, you're free to model the data any way that you see fit. It doesn't have to be, one extreme or the other. You could instead decide, well, I might be able to have one document that has the blog post and, let's say, the first 100 comments. And once a blog post, blog post may never hit 100 comments. And then everything fits in one document. But if it spills over, I can have another document that has kind of like a foreign key relationship to the post that it belongs to, with comments 101 through 200. And then when you spill over, 200 to 300, 300 to 400, and so on. Right? Again, there's no hard and fast rule for how you model your data. Right? But at the end of the day, it's really designed for hierarchical nested data, where all of the data that you're working with is either entirely or almost entirely self-contained in a single document. Data duplication is another aspect to normalization, of course. It's very common with a document database to duplicate data that you never would in the relational world. So, for example, here I've got a customer with order details, and I see black chair repeated twice, and I see yellow clock repeated three times. And very often, the document databases will do something like that just so that when I retrieve a document, I have all the information I need in that one document. I don't have to join against other documents. Of course, you need to be the judge of whether it's better, in terms of the trade-off between having everything in one place like you have here, compared to, well, what happens if I have to update the description of of yellow clocks? Well, now I have multiple documents that need updating. So again, it falls on you, and you might decide to model things again in a more, more like the way you would do it today with a relational database, and kind of join on the code BC for black chair and only have the description once. But again, you have to weigh each use case, right? At the end of the day, it's better. These document databases work best with hierarchical data, with everything that you need is either contained entirely or almost entirely self-contained. Not to say that you can't make it work, but if you find that you're dealing with many related documents and they're mostly flat and not hierarchical, then this could be an indication that a document database may not be the best tool for your application. Another unique aspect of document databases is the notion of eventual consistency, where in order to provide throughput and predictable performance levels, very often replicas are maintained behind the scenes so that queries can be serviced by multiple replicas and thereby deliver good performance. But of course, depending at what point in time you query and whether or not all the replicas have been updated, not everyone's going to get consistently updated information until eventually all the replicas get up to date, and that's why it's called eventual consistency. Of course, in the relational database world, we rely on strong consistency. If I update my bank balance, it is totally unacceptable at any point in time after that update that somebody should read the stale data and see the older balance, right? So that would be strong consistency compared to eventual consistency. I already started mentioning that relational databases do not, NoSQL databases do not and cannot replace SQL Server databases. I mean, the first time you try to do your first select count, you'll see exactly what I mean. In the relational world, how many rows are there in the table? Select count, you want to count how many documents are in the collection. Well, you might have to write a little bit of an elaborate stored procedure to do that, believe it or not. So simplicity rules, they're lean, they're simple, they're fast, they're good at what they do, but there's a lot that they don't do. So relational databases still have their place. It just means that they don't have the monopoly that they once had, right? We would always go with a relational database. And now that we have NoSQL alternatives, now we just have more choices. And finally, as I mentioned, document databases are designed to scale out. From the ground up, they were designed to easily scale out, infinitely, in fact. Whereas it's much more difficult to do with relational databases. You can do it, but it's hard and expensive, as you may already know. So enter DocumentDB. On April 8th, 2015, Microsoft launched Azure DocumentDB, and this is their Azure offering for NoSQL databases. And it can certainly be characterized as a NoSQL database, document database. It's massively scalable and it supports schema-free JSON documents, but there are certain characteristics that make DocumentDB stand out uniquely. First of all, yes, it's schema-free JSON, but we actually query using SQL, or I should say a special flavor of SQL that's been modified to work with JSON data. Right? So again, it may seem odd that you query this NoSQL database using something called SQL, but that's why NoSQL is just a bad term. Right? Also, you get transactional support, which you don't get in a lot of other document databases, meaning that there's a server-side programming model where you can update multiple documents and be guaranteed, you get the ACID guarantee, right, in terms of consistency, data consistency, that either all of the changes will commit or they will all roll back. You won't have partial updates when you're updating data on the server. It's highly tunable. You can tune for throughput, indexing, and consistency, which we'll talk more about. And it's a fully managed self-service platform running on Azure. You will never get your hands dirty configuring the software, setting up replicas, or patching software updates, or anything like that. It just runs in the cloud. Microsoft does all that work. They make sure that the service is always available. Here are some screenshots to show how easy it is to get started on the Azure portal. You just create a DocumentDB account. That's the root of where you create all your databases, and you just assign a name that's globally unique. And once you do that, you create a database, you give it a name that's unique, and you see I give it an ID. I'm calling this database MyDB, and now I've got a database called MyDB running inside my DocumentDB account. The DocumentDB resource model is a core fundamental concept, so let's kind of get it out of the way now so we all understand what it is. And all it is a hierarchy of containers. We already saw the first two on the previous slide. First, create a DocumentDB account, and that is the root container from which you can create one or more databases like you just saw on the last slide. Now, expanding the model out even further, within each database, you have collections. We'll talk more about what a collection is, but it's inside a collection that you store your JSON documents. And JSON documents can also be associated with one or more attachments, but I will mention now, and will again later, time permitting, that attachments are still in preview in terms of native attachments, and this is the ability to like attach like a JPEG image or a PDF file or any other kind of blob document that you might want to associate with your JSON document. At the database level, you can also configure users and permissions for fine-grained security over which users can access which resources in the database. And at the collection level, you can define stored procedures, triggers, and user-defined functions, which we'll talk more about. Now, these are our documents, these are our schema-free JSON documents, but in fact, all of these things are resources, and in fact, all of these things are represented as JSON. They all have JSON properties. At a minimum, every resource is going to have that ID, right? Like you saw in the database that I created called MyDB. That's as long as the name is unique within its parent container, you assign it a unique ID. But in addition, DocumentDB always assigns several system properties that all begin with an underscore, including the resource ID, which is some kind of hashed value that DocumentDB will always assign, and it's immutable. It will never change, unlike the ID that you and I can assign to any resource, which we can change anytime we want, as long as it's still unique. The resource ID will never change. There's also a timestamp property, underscore TS, that every resource gets is an epoch integer of value representing the date and time that that resource was last modified or created. There's an e-tag that it is used internally for optimistic concurrency to make sure that two users don't collide if they update at the same time. And there's a self property, underscore self, a self-link property, which is really a full path of resource IDs. If you look at this here, this is a resource ID to a document. Now, how do I know that it's a resource ID to a document and not to something else? Just by reading the resource, the self-link. It begins with DBS, which means databases collection, plural of database. And that's the resource ID of a particular database. That's the collections within that database, and that's a particular collection of that database. Within each collection, we have documents, and that's a particular document within that collection, within the database. Up until not too long ago, you would need to have to hold on to these self-links, because these are resource IDs that DocumentDB assigns, and if you wanted to work with this document, it would be necessary to cache or hold on to these self-links, which is very, very annoying. Because if you didn't know the self-link of a collection, then before you could query that collection for a document, you would first have to query for its self-link. And if you didn't know that self-link, you would also need to know the self-link for the database. So you would have to first query the database for its resource ID so that you could get the collection's resource ID just so that you could query for the document. It was not a pretty picture. And very, very recently, just this past August, they added a new feature. Just drop off that slash at the end, and you can plug in your own IDs. So I created a database called MyDB, I created a collection called Families, and there's a document in there that has an ID called Anderson Family, and that's a much more readable and manageable self-link to a resource. So now let's talk about collections, because it's really important to understand what a collection is. Yes, sir?
I have a question.
Yes.
So a document can have the same name, right, as long as it's in a different collection. So it would have...
Same ID.
Same ID. So it would have a different self-link.
The self-link would be different. Well, you mean if you had two, are you asking if you had two documents with the same ID in different collections, they would have unique resource IDs because they would have unique self-links because the collection part of the self-link would be different, right? Although, when we talk about partitioning later, you might want to ensure that your IDs are unique even across collections because you might have to shuffle documents around when you start partitioning your data. And one way to guarantee unique IDs is to like not assign the ID yourself, and if you don't assign the ID yourself, to a document, then DocumentDB will assign a GUID, and that is guaranteed to be unique, even if you move it from one collection to another.
GUID also is very difficult to remember.
GUID is very difficult to remember, and that's why you have some other identifier, maybe a username, maybe an email address, or something else that you could help you identify. But you would have to deal with the potential collision if you then moved it into another collection. The DocumentDB itself will not ensure uniqueness across collections. So a collection is certainly not a table. So get that out of your mind already. That's the first thing that we think of when we're coming from a SQL Server background. Oh, a collection is like a table. No, because if you were actually decided to model your data where you had customers in one document and their related orders in another document, you wouldn't create one collection to hold the customer documents and another collection to hold the order documents. This is a schema-free database. You would store them both in one collection, and it would be perfectly fine that they have radically different schemas. So it's not a table, it's more like a partition, not just logically, but also physically. So they also contain stored procedures, and that means if you write a stored procedure can only see the documents in that collection, right? But it's also a unit of scale and a unit of cost. They are 10 gigabytes in size. That may go up, but even if it goes up, it'll never be limitless, so you'll at some point need to scale out. And each one can also be set for three different levels of throughput, 250, 1,000, or 2,500 request units per second. What's a request unit? It's throughput currency. It's just an easy way of measuring. It's kind of a blended measure of CPU, disk, and I.O., and network, and all those kind of metrics kind of rolled into one. But it's also a physical boundary for transactions and queries. So when you run a query, you're querying all the documents in a single collection. When you are running a store procedure that's running on the server, I mentioned that you get transactional support. That's over the collection. If your store procedure modifies several documents within that collection, that transaction can either be committed and all the updates will get committed, or it will roll back and they'll all go away within a collection. How can you add documents to a collection? Many ways. You can use the Azure portal, which is a very raw way of doing it. You can actually type raw JSON. by hand, or you can upload JSON documents up to 100 at a time. For larger scale imports, there's a migration tool. And of course, you can do everything programmatically, which we'll talk more about shortly. There's a REST API, there are client SDKs, and there are stored procedures and triggers that can create documents as well. So here in the Azure portal, I just hand-typed a document for the Anderson family. And once you click Save, you have a document. You can see there's nothing magic in here. It's standard JSON. Curly braces, angle brackets, quotation marks. That's as complicated as it gets. Very simple. Here's how I can import, right? I might have two other JSON files that I can upload, so now I have three documents. There's a little document explorer. So without writing any code, just by having the portal and access to the portal, you can enter your documents, upload a handful, and browse them. Of course, you would want to use the data migration tool for larger scale imports, and this is capable of importing data from a great many data sources, even more than I've listed here. And they're constantly evolving it. And let me show you, now you see we can import from JSON, which would be very straightforward because we're going JSON to JSON, right? But what about SQL Server, right? It's not just about importing data, it's also about bridging that gap between the relational world and the document world, right? Where things are highly normalized in SQL Server, they're highly denormalized in DocumentDB. So let's see how that might work. Here's a query from the SQL Server AdventureWorks database, and look at all those joins, right? Because we have many, many tables that we need to join on to get a unified view of this data. So here's a view that does that, and it joins everything together, which gets us part of the way there for moving into the document world. The other part is, here you can see in this query, I'm querying from that view, so the joins are all inside that view. And look how I've aliased, I hope you can see, how I've aliased the columns here with these dots. So which means nothing to SQL Server, of course, but the data migration tool is going to be able to act on this and use that dot to figure out how to shape the document. You can see I have ID and name, but in terms of when it comes to the address, address is a top-level object that has nested within it address type, address line 1, and in case of city and state, there's a location object that's further nested, and within that I have city and state province name. And based on the way that I have set up the aliases with those dots, when I take that query and I paste it into the migration tool, and it asks me for the nesting separator, that's where I put the dot. I tell the tool, look for that dot, and as a result, you see the shape of the document that got created. This has been imported from SQL Server. We can see the ID and name, but address is a nested object. And location is a further nested object with city and state province name. So it does a pretty good job at converting flat, normalized data into rich, hierarchical JSON for DocumentDB. How do you query this thing? We also have a link alternative, if you prefer. Using the .NET SDK, you want to query with language integrated query. But SQL is the native way of querying DocumentDB. And at first glance, this looks like ordinary SQL, but if you take a slightly closer look, you can see it's actually not quite ordinary SQL. Look at the dotted notation. Right? Here's where I'm basically saying I'm querying from the family collection, and we see join that looks familiar, we see a where clause that looks familiar, but like many things in DocumentDB, there's a twist here. This is not your standard select statement. First of all, SQL, as I mentioned earlier, DocumentDB will not join two documents together. This is an intra-document join, joining within the document. So taking the child elements of an array and flattening them out and duplicating the parent information that is apparent to that array and generating new documents. So it will flatten that way, it will join that way, and using dotted notation you can reach into and navigate to any property no matter how deeply nested it may be within the hierarchy. And the moment you drop a JSON document in, it's instantaneously queryable, unless you modify the default indexing strategy, which we'll talk about, or I should say indexing policy, but we'll talk about that more in a moment. But by default, as soon as you drop a document, it's instantaneously queryable on any property. Oh, that's what I just said. And you can tune this, although you usually won't need to. Usually the default indexing policy will be sufficient for most needs. Yes, sir, in the back.
I think you can also use Azure Search for that now, right?
Azure Storage for what?
Azure Search.
Azure Search. Well, Azure Search is another alternative here. If you find, I was talking about some documents where if you look at them, DocumentDB may not be the best solution. If you have a document that has, let's say, two properties in it, like an ID and another property that's just like a book or a paragraph, Yeah, I could use the document DB for that, but Azure Search would be a much better solution for.
You present the Redmond this way, use document DB, in other words, build better Azure Search.
And you can of course always have a hybrid solution as well. Yeah, but if you were just dealing with like data that you wanted to do full text search on, Azure Search is a better alternative than document database. So there's a SQL grammar. And that makes it very approachable, right? So it's a new technology, but they really try to leverage many existing technologies. Everyone knows JSON. Anyone who's doing any web development is working with JSON. SQL is going to be comfortable to anyone coming from a SQL background, except that it's rooted in JSON and JavaScript semantics. And what I mean by that is you're not working with SQL data types, you're working with JSON data types, which are far fewer, right? You have numbers, strings, dates, nulls, Boolean object, and I think that's it, right? And there's far more SQL data types. Right? So you have your familiar syntax, but like I said, using dotted notation, you can descend into any subsection of an array, you can iterate nested arrays, you can say select star, which we all know in SQL Server is discouraged, but you don't have that negative stigma in document databases. There's nothing wrong with select star in a document DB, it just means return the document as it's shaped in the database. But you can, instead of saying select star, you can custom shape your JSON any way you want. You can reshape it any way you might need to, depending on your needs. Right? You might need to materialize a list. You might not need to return all the properties of a document. So you can shape the document any way that you want. It has many of the common operators that you would expect. No surprises here. Standard arithmetic, bitwise, logical, and comparison operators are all supported. No surprise there. String concatenation as well. A host of built-in functions. Of course, we have many of the standard math functions. The type checking functions are indispensable when you're dealing with a schema-free database, right? Because sometimes, or very often, you might need to test to see if a property is present or not. Like that earlier example where some documents have the name stored in a property called name, other documents have the name property stored in a property called full name. You can use these type checking properties to kind of present a unified view of the data, even though internally you have different schemas. And all your standard string manipulations, concatenation, and the trimming, and so on, reversing, replicating, uppercasing, lowercasing, and you can slice and dice arrays any way you might need to as well, concatenating them, testing to see if an array contains a certain element, the length of an array, and slicing arrays. Talking about indexing, there are a number of index types that are supported. There's the hash index, which enables equality tests. Makes it very efficient to test for something being equal, but they can be used to check for inequality or less than, greater than, or range type of searches. That's what you need a range index for. Now, to be clear, if you don't have a range index, you still can perform range searches, but DocumentDB won't be able to leverage an index, and you will have to sequentially scan each document, which will be much slower. If you have a range index, then your range queries will perform much better. And if you want to sort using order by, which believe it or not, was not possible when DocumentDB first launched. You couldn't even sort your results, right, with order by. Now you can, but you'll need a range index with maximum precision if you want to be able to sort using order by, and you'll need to do that separately for numbers and strings. Right? A certain property could be in both a number and a string, or it could even not be present in a document. This is schema-free. No rules on schema, no rules on data types. So if you want to have a property be able to contain both numbers and strings and be sortable, then you would need a range index with maximum precision on numbers and another range index with maximum precision on strings. So the indexing policy is established at the collection level. There's a default policy that indexes everything, but you can override that and you can change that after the collection is created. So what are the types of things you can set in an indexing policy? Well, whether it should be automatic, which by default it is. So with automatic indexing, when you drop a document into the collection, it gets indexed. Unless you request otherwise on a document level, at the document level, when you create a document, you can say override that policy, don't index this document. Why would you not want to index a document if you don't need to index it? Because indexing, there's overhead with indexes. And unindexed documents still can be retrieved by their ID or their self-link, but by no other property, because no other properties will get indexed. But you can flip that. You can say, well, the indexing policy of this collection is manual. That means unless I say otherwise, when I add a document to the collection, it does not get indexed unless at the document level I override that and say, yes, please index this document. Then within a document, you can include or exclude certain paths. It might not be necessary to index every property in the document if you know that you're only querying on a handful of them. You can cut down on overhead. And then there's indexing mode, which can be consistent or lazy. The default is consistent, meaning that the moment you add a document to the collection, it is instantaneously queryable because the index gets updated synchronously. However, if you can tolerate a little bit of latency, where it's okay for some amount of time to elapse after you add the document but before you can query on it, then you can improve performance by using lazy indexing, and that is when DocumentDB will not index the document right away, but instead will wait until there's a pause in processing and resources free up and it can catch its breath like I'm trying to do, and say, okay, there's a little bit of time here to, I can index these documents. Here are some examples of index paths. I can say, I just need the name property index or the state property beneath the address property index. I just use simple slash syntax. And a question mark means a scalar value, and asterisk means all values beneath it, all descending values, all properties that descend, no matter how deep they may be. So I just need properties beneath the address property index, and nothing else. But beneath address, every descending property, no matter how deep it may be, the index. And here I'm saying, beneath the item property that's in the root, there's a colors array, and I want that and all of its nested properties to be indexed. All right, let's talk now about client development. And it looks like I'm only about 5 minutes over, so I'll try to catch up on some time here. So for client development, we have, like most things in Azure, DocumentDB's native interface is REST over HTTP. So there's nothing you can't do if you don't construct the appropriate REST call that is set up the HTTP headers just right. Now, it's okay if you don't know what the heck I mean by that, because you normally would not want to use the REST API. It is the most primitive, low-level way of communicating with DocumentDB. It's a great learning tool to see what's, get a glimpse at the REST API or get a glimpse at the HTTP traffic to enhance your appreciation and understanding of what's going on behind the scenes. But normally, you would not use the REST API if you were developing in any of these platforms, because Microsoft has an SDK that abstracts the ugliness of the REST API away from you. And they are kind of listed in order of popularity here. So the .NET SDK is the most popular. Node.js comes after that. And there are also SDKs for JavaScript, Java, and Python. So how do you connect to DocumentDB from your client application? You need two things. You need an endpoint and a key. The endpoint is merely a URL that includes your account name, followed by .documents, .azure, .com. And the key is one of two things, either a master key or a resource token. So a master key, think of that like an SA account. You don't want to be giving this away. It allows full unfettered access to the entire, to your entire account, all databases within the account, all collections and documents within those databases. But you don't want to distribute those to client environments. You want to keep that in your middle tier. And there's actually two of these keys to enable key rotation. It makes it easy for you to change the key without disrupting services. So the way it works is you have a primary key and a secondary key, and all of your applications are configured to use the primary key, and when you want to change that key, you first reconfigure your applications to use the secondary key. Once you've done that, then you click regenerate keys. It regenerates the primary key. You regenerate the primary key, right? And that takes a little bit of time to replicate out, and once that's been updated, then you reconfigure your applications back to use the primary key. That's a standard key rotation technique. And there are also read-only versions of those master keys. So if you've used the read-only version, you can see everything, but you can't change anything. There, you just click read-only keys, and then you have a set of read-only keys. Users and permissions, they are the basis for resource tokens. So you can connect either with a master key, or you can connect with a resource token, and that gives you granular secure control over security. So what you do is you create one or more users for the database, and then for each user you create one or more permissions, and those permissions generate resource tokens that have a lifetime. They don't live forever. After a while you'll have to refresh and get an updated resource token. And that will give you kind of a more fine-grained control over security. So programming with the REST API, I think I'm going to skip on over this because I kind of more or less made the main point that you normally won't use the REST API unless you're working on a platform for which there is no SDK, you would want to use an SDK and it would be much simpler. But if you're using the REST API, you have to supply an endpoint and a key, and there's quite a bit of work to encrypt that master key into the HTTP header just right. And in the sample code that I showed you the link for, if you're interested, I went through that pain for you in case so that you won't have to. But normally, if you're building in .NET or Node.js, you're going to want to use one of the available SDKs. And it's really much simpler with an SDK. In the case of .NET, you create a document client instance. In the constructor, you supply the connection information, which is the endpoint and the key. And then you have a document client object that can do anything. You can create databases, collections, documents, query. You can run queries. You can create stored procedures. You can run stored procedures all through that document client object. And you also get a lot of flexibility in the .NET world, right, in terms of the types of objects you can use to represent your documents. So obviously it could just be a string because JSON is just text. So obviously a document could just be a string. But that's, you know, wouldn't be the most easily, you know, it's not that easy to work with just a string. You can use COBOs. So you can actually define .NET classes, right, which is, let's say, your business domain objects, and use those as your documents, as your document class. Or you can use Dynamics, right? That works very, very well with the schema-free world of JSON documents, right? Because it's a dynamic object. The properties are not known at compile time. They are resolved at runtime. And so they work very, very well with schema-free documents. Yes, sir, question in the back.
And with few schema-free documents, you also have to be aware that when they're
triggered and terabytes? Well, I didn't mention that the maximum size of a document in DocumentDB is 512K.
Yeah, because I was trying to fit all my PDFs in one DB.
Well, we're not talking about that type of document, right? We're talking about plain text JSON documents. So when people hear 10 gigabytes per collection, that doesn't sound like a very big number. When they hear 512K maximum document size, that doesn't sound like a very big number. But remember, we're talking about plain text. You can store a lot of plain text in 10 gig. And 512K is half a meg, is quite large. You're talking about attachments, right? You would not embed those in, right? So, in terms of working with the SDK, it's all asynchronous, but using the task parallel library makes this much easier. Because that normally means working with callbacks. Ever work with callbacks? Right? You call a function, and one of the parameters you pass is another function to be called back after it finishes, because it's asynchronous. And when you have many calls to make, it starts getting ugly when you chain these things. It's much easier with the .NET SDK. That's the synchronous version on the left. With the task parallel library, you can write asynchronous code that looks synchronous. You just decorate the methods with the async keyword. Instead of returning void, you return task, and you add the word await. And then basically, at that point, you get synchronous behavior with asynchronous code. And if you need to return something, like not void, you need to return a string, then you return task of that type. So instead of returning a string, you will return a task of string.
Task object.
So, beg your pardon?
Task object.
Task object, that's correct. But it resolves to void.
Okay.
Just like, so this task object resolves to void because of the async. Okay. Just like this task of string resolves to a string. I'm saying here that I'm returning a task of string, but what am I returning? A string. Because it's sugar, this is all sugar coding. This is all sugar-coated syntax for what's really happening behind the scenes, because you really are returning a task object because it's asynchronous. But you don't have to concern yourself with that. You just write the code as if it was synchronous. It really makes life a lot easier. Right? So let's just talk a little bit about DocumentDB and JavaScript, because this can get a little bit confusing. There are three ways that DocumentDB can work with JavaScript. One is using the Node.js SDK. Like I just talked about the .NET SDK. Well, if you want to develop in Node.js, then you're writing in JavaScript, but it's the same resource model. It's the resource model that you have to wrap your brain around. Once you understand the resource model, then it doesn't matter which SDK you're working with, or even when you're working with server-side code. You understand the containers and the resource model. So those are apps that run on the server. Now there's also a JavaScript SDK for apps that run on the client, so-called two-tiered applications. And then there's server-side programming, which is stored procedures, user-defined functions, and triggers. And that runs within the DocumentDB service. And those are always written in JavaScript. Even if you're working with a .NET SDK and writing C# code, you are writing your stored procedure in JavaScript and shipping it off to the server as JavaScript code. So if you're programming with a Node, I'm going to skip over this slide in the interest of time. I have not too many Node.js developers in this room, I'm guessing.
Actually, you have three. You got to ask.
Please, that's fine.
Practice for my session.
Sure. Node.js. We skip that. JavaScript SDK. I talked about this one briefly, but you know, this is actually discouraged from being used. If you're building a client-side application for DocumentDB as a two-tiered application, you're discouraged from using the JavaScript SDK. First of all, they don't support master keys. And think about why. It means giving your master key out, you know, to end users, which we don't want to do. So it only supports resource tokens. And that means you're going to need a middle tier. At a minimum, you're going to need some middle tier so that the middle tier can use a master key to talk to DocumentDB and get and query for permissions for the particular user so it can get that resource token, so it can pass the resource token back to the JavaScript SDK client, the client that's working with the JavaScript SDK, so that it can talk to DocumentDB directly using resource tokens because master keys are unsupported. So once you get to that point where you've already set up a middle tier, it's just usually a better idea to use the middle tier for everything. Right, and avoid the noisy neighbor scenario where you got a million different clients hitting DocumentDB as opposed to one kind of middle tier that is handling all the requests for all the clients coming in as a single client to DocumentDB. Not to mention that you'll also have to resolve the cross-origin resource sharing issue if it's a browser that we're talking about as opposed to a Windows Store application. And that is very painful to resolve, trust me. All right, so now let's talk about the server-side programming model. It looks like we're on track. This is code that runs inside DocumentDB, right? So store procedures, triggers, and user-defined functions. This is what Microsoft calls JavaScript as modern T-SQL because of the way that they have integrated JavaScript, the language that so many developers today are using to build applications, with the database engine. So your procedural logic is written in JavaScript. But the object model, again, it's all about the resource model. You have to understand the hierarchy of account, database. Within a database, you have collections. Collections have documents, and collections have stored procedures, user-defined functions, and triggers. Remember that slide that showed the resource model? You wrap your brain around that, you're good for any SDK or the REST API or server-side programming. It's really all the same once you understand the resource model. And like I said, you get transactional support. So if your store procedure or trigger is updating multiple documents, then they are all guaranteed to commit or roll back. And it's implicit. You don't have to begin the transaction. It's within the lifetime of the execution of your store procedure. Everything is transactionalized. Now, in terms of the lifetime of the execution of your store procedure, there is this thing called bounded execution. This is a service that Microsoft has to keep up and running. You can't just bring it down by writing bad code that runs and negatively impacts the performance of the service. So there is a time limit, and that time limit is 5 seconds. Your store procedure cannot run for more than 5 seconds. It will get terminated, and that is something known as bounded execution. So if you want to do something that takes more than 5 seconds for a long-running process, you need to implement some sort of continuation model. I'll give you one example. Bulk insert. Maybe I have 1,000 documents I want to insert, and instead of inserting one at a time from the client, it'll be more efficient to send them all to the server in one store procedure and add them on the server. Yeah, but the server, there might not be enough time to insert all 1,000 documents. So you might have to have some sort of continuation model, something that you figure out. You just figure out some way of letting the client get a signal that all the work didn't get done. For example, you can return a parameter saying how many documents got inserted. I send in 1,000. If I get back a number that says 1,000, great. If I get back a number that says 600, I know only 600 got inserted, and I need to make the call again, sending in the next 400, and kind of looping that way. So that's one example of a continuation model. And beyond that, you have to account for throttling errors. Because remember I said that there's this, it's depending on what you pay for per collection, because you pay by collection, you'll either get 250, 1,000, or 2,500 request units per second. And if you try to push more than that through a single request, well, then DocumentDB will start throttling your requests, which is the politically correct way of saying it's just going to throw errors at you. It's going to throw a 429 at you. But it'll also tell you in this header how long to wait before you should try again. Okay? How do you create a store procedure? You just write a store procedure. You just write a JavaScript function, I mean. That's it. It's just a JavaScript function. And within that JavaScript function, you get this object called the context. From the context, you get the collection and the response object. And once you have the collection, you can run any queries. You can do any operations against that collection, just like you do on the client. Send whatever response you want back to the client by modifying the response object. It's really as simple as that. Again, for long-running processes, you'll have to test for bounded execution. Everything that you do inside your stored procedure, DocumentDB will return a Boolean telling you if it was accepted or not. And if you're bumping up close against that 5-second time limit, DocumentDB will start returning a Boolean telling you, no, that request was not accepted. It won't be at the last possible millisecond. It'll be when you're close, and that way it gives you enough time maybe to clean up what you're doing and return it cleanly to the user with some signal that it needs to be called again to complete the balance of the work. Trigger? Yes?
Can you do multi-threading?
Can you do multi-threading? No. There's a lot you can't do, but it's full JavaScript. It's a JavaScript sandbox, essentially. Triggers? I don't like to talk much about triggers. Why? Because the last bullet point here, they're not really triggers. Or at least they're not triggers in the true relational database sense of the word. Meaning, they don't fire automatically. So there's nothing, which is bizarre. Means they're associated with a create or replace operation, but when you do that create or replace and you want that trigger to run, or more than one trigger to run, you have to explicitly say, run these triggers. Bizarre, certainly strange behavior. They're aware of this. We can expect this to change, but until it does, I don't want to even waste time talking to you about something that you can achieve everything with a trigger, with a stored procedure like you can with a trigger. UDFs? UDFs are interesting. They work the way you would expect them to. They don't have access to the request or the response objects. They can't query for documents or modify documents. They're compute only. So tax calculations, any kind of business logic that you might want in a calculation. Where you need to be careful is using it in the WHERE clause, because obviously we can't in advance index the results of a UDF, not knowing what the result will be. So it will always be a scan. You can mitigate the concern by structuring your query in a way that by the time it gets to your UDF, it has already reduced the potential number of results down using indexes. And then you'll have to sequentially scan through the rest to test for your UDF. In the few minutes we have remaining, I'm going to just go through a bunch of the different topics. We talked about tunable consistency. We talked about strong consistency and eventual consistency at the beginning of the session. But in fact, DocumentDB offers two in-betweens, two additional consistency levels that fall somewhere in between strong and eventual. So with strong consistency, the writer writes, and everybody waits until all the replicas get updated, or I should say, most of the replicas, the quorum, the majority of replicas, where by the point in time that all those replicas have been updated, DocumentDB knows that it can consistently return the same data to everybody, right? So everyone gets, you're guaranteed the consistently latest updated data, but it's also the slowest in performance because of the waiting. Eventual consistency is really the other end of the spectrum, because queries can return stale data before the quorum gets updated. So again, the writer writes, but this time nobody waits. Everybody can read data immediately. There's no waiting, but there's also no guarantee that, so if I update my age, because I'm always changing my age, today I'm 28, but until that time, right, so the reader's reading, oh, how old is that? He's 28. No, it says he's 36. Oh, it says he's 28 again, 36 again. No, which is it? And then until eventually the replicas get updated, right? So this is really the other extreme because it's the fastest, there's no waiting, but there's also no guarantee of consistency. So what are these two in-betweens? They're really quite clever. One of them is called bounded staleness. With bounded staleness, the writer writes and everybody waits, but nobody waits longer than the amount of time that you define as being how long you would consider acceptable. And at that point, everybody receives consistent data. It might not be the most up-to-date data, but it will be consistent. I'll get the same answer to the same question until it becomes more current, but it'll never have that seemingly randomness, which is like bizarre during that period of time until the quorum gets updated, where it seems bizarre to be getting random answers. And then there's session consistency. This is a very nice trade-off. And this is a very good level, and that, in fact, is why it is the default consistency level. You can think of session consistency as strong consistency for the writer, eventual consistency for everyone else. So again, the writer writes. But when the writer reads their own information, they're guaranteed to read the most current version of what they just wrote, while everyone else might have to wait. And this is great for most common scenarios, right? Very often, you want to be sure right away, after you've written something, that it's been written. And when you read it back, you want to be sure that it's what you just wrote and not some stale version. Meanwhile, for everyone else, it's perfectly acceptable. It's like if I update my cat picture, it's okay if everybody waits a few seconds on Facebook to see the newest picture of my cat. That's fine. But I want, right, when I post it, I want to see right away that it was posted, right? That kind of thing. And you get that kind of hybrid functionality with strong and eventual consistency. Right, so you can set the default consistency at the database account level. But like I said, by default, that's a session. But you can override that on the query level. But when you override it, you can only override it to a weaker consistency. So you might have strong consistency set. Normally, you want strong consistency. But there might be times, I'm issuing a query. I want my answer back as fast as possible, and I don't care if it's inconsistent or stale. So for this query, I'm going to override and say, give me eventual consistency behavior for the performance. Right? So it's really, really nice that you get this kind of fine-tuning. Well, either Microsoft will run out of hardware in their data centers, or you'll run out of money, and I'm guessing you'll run out of money before they run out of hardware. So pretty big, huge in fact. We're talking hundreds of terabytes, even petabytes, and you don't really even have to take my word for it, because DocumentDB is already proven at scale. There is already in use for Xbox, OneNote. These are massive, massive services that are currently backed by DocumentDB. In fact, that's how DocumentDB started. It started internally within Microsoft, yeah. And then they woke up and realized we have to release this as a product in the face of MongoDB and others. So we can see 10 gigabyte increase to a larger maximum capacity for a collection, but even then it'll never be limitless. So you scale that by adding, you just add more collections, right? So the simplest way to partition your data, because there are different ways, there are different partitioning strategies that you might take, and they're all based on a partition key, except this one. This is the simplest partitioning, spillover partitioning. No partition key. This is a great strategy when you're unsure about a lot of things, because normally you set up a partitioning strategy based on how you understand people are going to query your data, and you might not have that understanding up front. You might not even know up front if you'll ever need more than a collection. You just, a lot of unknowns. This is my new application might take off, and I'll have to scale that, hopefully, or it'll be a flop, and I'll never need more than one collection, right? You just don't know up front. So you start off with one, the collection starts, and you start filling it up, and you let it grow, and it grows to a point where it gets nearly full, and you don't want to wait till it gets completely full. You'll have a headache at that point. So you define some fill factor, let's say 90%. When it hits 90%, it just spills over, and you start filling up the next collection. It's as simple as that, and then start allowing that to fill up. So for creating new documents, it's a no-brainer. You always add them to the last collection. When that collection reaches 90%, you add another collection. For querying, on the other hand, it's another story. It's not that efficient, right? Because when you're querying, the document you're looking for could be in any one of these collections, so you have to fan that query out to all the collections. So once your spillover partitioning grows beyond a certain number of collections, you're going to want to migrate to another strategy, very commonly range partitioning, most typically on dates, where you pick a particular range that you feel comfortably can fit in a collection under all circumstances. And let's say in this scenario, we know that we can definitely fit a month's worth of data in a collection, and it'll never be more than 10 gig per month. So you buy an S3 collection, which is the most expensive collection you can buy, and it gives you the best throughput you can have for June 2015. And when it comes July, you buy another S3, but you also downgrade the June, because most folks are querying for current data. So most of the hits are going to be for current data, fewer for a month ago. And then the next month, you'll even scale that down further to an S1, because it's very rare that users are querying for data that old, and so on. And so you go month after month, and scale out really infinitely. With the right partitioning strategy, you can achieve infinite scale. And with the DocumentDB SDK, they have built-in partition resolvers, so that you just query the database. The resolver, based on the partition key, figures out which collection or collections, in the case of a fan-out query, it needs to execute. It'll execute multiple queries, fan them out, aggregate the results, give you back a single result set. It's very nice. It gives you a very, very nice experience. Lookup partitioning is just another variation. You might have the shard map, as it's called, that says, depending on the region, it goes in, you know, I might have one collection for US East, US West, another collection for all of Europe, and another collection for Asia Pacific and any other region, whatever works for you. But you might have to rebalance and shuffle these things around as you change your partitioning strategy. That's why, for the gentleman's question earlier about unique IDs, you have to make sure that your IDs are unique within each document. You can combine them also, right? So here I have lookup partitioning, but within, if one customer is too big for a single partition, then they might spill over to another. And with that, I'm not going to talk much about attachments in maybe 30 seconds. They're just discouraged from use. Here's the reason. You only get 2 gigabytes of attachment storage for the entire database account, not even a single database, and that's not very much. So you can only embrace this feature if you're storing tiny, tiny blobs in each document, or perhaps slightly larger blobs, but fewer of them. But you certainly can't scale. And the reason that this is stuck in preview and probably will never see the light of day is because there are much better ways of doing this. Azure Blob Storage is a much better solution, and it has support for CDN, Content Delivery Network. And it just doesn't make sense for the DocumentDB team to try to keep pace with features of another service that is already out there that has a lot of benefits for blob storage. So it's usually better to store your blobs in something like Azure Blob Storage and take advantage of that, and just store a link to it in your document. Pricing. There you have it, S1, S2, or S3. You're paying really for request units per second. And you're paying it roughly between $25 a month, $50 a month, or $100 a month per collection, depending on the level of throughput that you need. I've got a bunch of links here to take it to the next step. Of course, I recommend my new Pluralsight course, but there's also Microsoft Virtual Academy. There's a deep dive there. Learning Mat has lots of great links. There's a query playground. You can go and play with queries without even setting up a document database. And with that, I want to thank you for listening so fast. Good luck with DocumentDB, and let me know if you have any questions. Yeah.
About progression.